Professor Rubenstein's immigration law class on the 1st of December 2008, podcast number 2 in room 243.
If you're not hungry now, you have to always have books. So, are you covering material class today, or are you just reading these today?
He's going to do some covering of the stuff he did last time. I don't know if he's going to cover a cross section. Then he's going to do a few things in the second half.
She knows definitely too.
I'm just saying. I think I'm going to say so scrutiny is available.
Okay, yeah.
That would take his
Thank you. Okay, everybody, let's begin. Yes, this is going to be our last class together. We have class scheduled for tomorrow, but it's canceled. And what I'm going to do, sort of as a makeup class, is if you, I got a number of questions, which I'm going to go over today. If you have additional questions, then you can email them to me, and I will do a podcast on Thursday or Friday with whatever questions you send me, and that will constitute the makeup class for whatever we miss Tuesday. If I get one or two questions, I may just email. I'll respond to everybody. I'll take the name off so it'll be anonymous. I'll just respond to everybody. But if I get a number of them, it'll just be easier for me to do it verbally. And what I'm going to miss you guys.
I miss you.
I am. It was, you know, You guys were great. You really were great, and I will always remember you because you were my first. So for better or worse, you know, everybody says, "How's your immigration class going?" I think it's great. I mean, it may turn out that next year is much, much better. But I have nothing to compare it to. So if nothing else, I'm going to remember you all very fondly, and I wanted to thank you for making it such a fun experience for everybody. I don't think I'm going to go the full 2 hours today because I actually have to get out of here, but I'll go as long as necessary to finish up these asylum problems and to do answer some of the questions or all the questions that you sent me. And it may take 2 hours to get through all this, but if it doesn't, we're going to end early. And then let you start studying for your exams. So we were talking about asylum last class. Let's look at problem 3. I'm not sure which page it's on. Let's see. What is it? 1050. So take a minute to think about that one. Hopefully you've thought about this before class because I want to go through these rather quickly. Than some of the others. As you know, I've already told you there's going to be an asylum question on the exam, which isn't a surprise because I told you. But anyway, I thought I would remind you for those who didn't get the message the first time. There's going to be lots of other questions too, but you could be sure that you're safe studying the asylum stuff because there will be a question on it. First question, what do you guys think? What are some of the issues and what do you think about them? Where would you start?
So I guess we started on whether or not it would qualify as persecution.
Okay, good. That's, I think, a really good place to start. Does it qualify as persecution? And what is actually is she complaining about? Or how could you sort of parse what she's complaining about in terms of it being persecution or not? Yeah.
Let's say complaining about people being mean to her.
Okay. That's fine. What else is she complaining about? What is it?
Pigeonholing.
Pigeonholing in what way? Okay. And how else is she complaining, Brian? Okay, so the government's not giving loan to women. So let's think about each of those. I think that pretty much sums it up. What about people being mean to her? Is that persecution?
No.
Probably not. What about her being pigeonholed to work at home? Is that persecution? Probably not. What about her not being able to attend college? Is that persecution? Probably not. What about if she's being deprived of her opportunity to choose her career choice? Persecution? Probably not. I think that, you know, as you get into... What if she was denied the opportunity to attend elementary school? Persecution? Maybe. Matt? I think that's exactly right. I think what makes this less troublesome is that this is like the cherry on top that she's not getting. And so if she was being denied, you know, elementary school, at middle school, what might be considered as basic fundamental human rights, that's looking a lot more like persecution than this case is. Let's assume it is persecution there, though, which is what you'd want to do on a test. You know, it looks like it's not persecution for these reasons, but let's assume it is. Where do you go next? What's the next part of the analysis? Let's assume it's persecution. Daniel? What do you say? Who's doing the persecution? So here it's, if it's the people, you know, then we don't even know from these facts whether they're unable or unwilling to control them. If it's the government, then that's a separate, with the declining her the money to go to school, then that's the government, so it could satisfy it. What else after persecution? What's the next step? Let's put persecution aside. Not yet. Okay, so see if she falls into one of the five categories. Which ones are applicable here, do you think? Okay, so maybe social group. How would you define her social group? Okay, so women is, and is that a social group? Okay, women is a social group, but now here's the problem. Think back to Faith, the Faith case. Is she being persecuted on account of her being a woman? Is that... I mean, let's we have to sort of define what the persecution is. I mean, if we say that people being mean to her is definitely not persecution, that this, if it's persecution at all, it's only because the government is denying her money to attend college, okay? So is she being denied on account of her being a woman? I mean, it's sort of hard to say. I mean, I think what, you may have to parse it a little bit thinner as the social group consisting of women who want to attend college. Because I don't see the government necessarily persecuting women because they're women. I see them persecuting women who want to, if it's persecution, which I don't think it is, women who want to go to college. And so then the question is, well, her womanhood is clearly immutable. Is her desire to want to go to college, is that immutable? Yeah. Yeah, you can. You want to make the argument that it's fundamental to her liberty and it's not the type of thing that we should require her not to have. But again, it's not a clear question. You make the argument. And now, is immutability sufficient? Let's assuming it's immutable. Is that enough? Jen? No, why?
Well, I don't know. But my problem is, she can't go to college.
Okay, that's good. That's right. That's another way to slice the pie. So the government is not precluding her from going to college. They're precluding her because they just won't give her money to go. That's good. So that would cut against her being persecuted on account of even that more narrow social group. Patrick?
She has to show that there's individualized harm.
Individualized harm. That goes to the persecution prong that we covered at the beginning. Yes, she'll have to show individualized harm. She could get around it by showing that she's a member of a group, women who want to attend college. So it's possible she could get around that. Now, the other, what else, in addition to immutability, do you need to establish social group, to claim asylum for social group purposes? Within the social, it's under the heading of social group. It's the case, the BIA case we looked at, the supplemental reading. Yes.
Social,
right, social visibility is one, okay. And what else?
Particularity.
Right, and particularity is the other. And we don't think we have enough facts here to make a determination as to that. Again, you need to read carefully the decision because it's not clear whether those are requirements or important factors. In one sense, I think in the end, it looks like they're important considerations that will apply in every case, although it's not clear that if you don't have them, you'll necessarily be denied asylum. You'll have to take a look at the language of the case and tell me what you think it says. Okay, so that's that for this problem. Problem four. A Protestant couple from a predominantly Roman Catholic country object to a law that prohibits the sale or possession of any artificial birth control device. Violators of the law are punishable by up to a year in prison. The couple has made a firm decision not to have children. take it then. Okay, so is it persecution? Yes. You think it's prosecution, okay. Why?
Because you have to violate the law in order to be
okay, so you think it's prosecution. What's the argument that it's persecution? That maybe you have to make some assumptions that are not in the facts here, yeah?
Is not wanting to have children a fundamental liberty?
What did it say? No. Say it again. It's not wanting to have children.
Right,
oh, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't think it's laughable. I think that's a good question. What else do you think? What's the argument that it's persecution? Well, we know it's a predominantly Roman Catholic country.
Yeah, but that's implicit. The facts don't show that that type of religion forced that practice on them.
Okay. So we don't know what's motivating the law. I mean, yeah, this is one of those cases where you have arguably a facially neutral law, and then the question becomes, is the government trying to overcome their beliefs? Are they trying to punish their beliefs? Are they singling out these people, even though the law is applied neutrally on their face? Whether they're doing it, you know, whether there's... It's clear from the legislative history, let's say there's a legislative history, or whether in practice only these people are being, only a certain denomination are being targeted for the law, then that might start looking a lot like persecution. Or if the penalty is not commensurate with the offense. And here, you know, if it's just up to a year in prison, maybe, you know, to the extent that this law could be justified, it doesn't seem too outrageous. Like if it was, you know, 10 years in prison or death, well, that's a very different story, obviously. All right. Not much more to say there. And then finally, a 20-year-old woman left her country, which is ruled by a despot, and with whose armed forces routinely round up and execute anyone who speaks out in opposition. She has testified that she is consumed by hatred of her country's ruler, that because of the consequences of dissidence, she forced herself to remain silent, and that she finally left the country because she was going to lose her cap. She says her feelings have grown so intense that if she were sent back, she knows she would have to speak her mind. What do you think? Is persecution? Fear of, well, is this a well-founded fear of persecution? Right.
So, consequence for speaking out,
right. So it certainly rises to the level of harm, right? Because she's fearing death. You'd have to know more facts to know whether or not that fear was well-founded, whether there's any support for it, for example, in the State Department reports or other Human Rights Watch reports. The only thing that this problem is really intended to highlight is, are we going to protect this person who sort of is establishing her right to asylum through acts or through beliefs that she's done while she's been in the United States? I mean, while she was there, she was able to stifle herself. But now, all of a sudden, if she goes back, she's not going to be able to stifle her speech. And does our asylum laws protect somebody who essentially backdoors their way into an asylum claim? What's the answer for that? Anybody?
defeat the argument?
Well, yeah, the problem is, or a potential problem is, so she's there, you know, she disagrees with this stuff, but she never speaks out, and therefore never suffers the consequences. Then she comes here, and now all of a sudden she decides, I won't be able to keep myself quiet any longer. If I go back, I am going to speak out, and therefore these terrible things are going to happen to me. So, does our asylum laws protect someone like this?
Well, maybe not initially, but since they you know, look for people who speak out and then persecute them, right? The fact that there is a public record of her having sought asylum and speaking out in our court proceedings would say that even though she may not originally have an asylum claim, she can then say, but now that I've spoken out in this proceeding, they're going to know and they're going to pursue me back. So even if I can't keep my mouth shut, they're still going to persecute me.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Now, I should say that, I don't think I mentioned it, that asylum applications are anonymous. And so we're actually not allowed to share that information with anybody. Although people fear, you know, people are coming from dictatorship countries really never believe that that's actually going to be the case. So they have fears rooted in their own perceptions. But as a legal matter, we are not entitled to release this information, although people, you know, communities are small and word of mouth gets back, so it's possible that even though we're not releasing the information, it's coming from others. Certainly your approach is one, but the facts say she, you know, putting that aside, the facts here say that she will speak out. And, you know, the quick answer is, you know, this is the refugee surplace point, that we will recognize this type of persecution, assuming it's credible, or Brandon's Falun Gong example. You know, assuming it's credible, even though they weren't Falun Gong practitioners or even though they weren't speaking out, if they are now and there's a realistic or at least a well-founded fear that the government's going to find out about it, either because someone's going to tell them or because they're not going to be able to practice Falun Gong or speak out in the privacy of their own home, then you have a potential asylum claim and you treat it like any other. All right. Any questions about asylum in general? What? Okay. Let's talk about withholding of removal, and I got a question about that that I'm going to cover in the review. Withholding of removal, the standard is higher. Okay, you have to instead of well-founded fear, you have to show that it's more likely than not that she'll be persecuted, and so otherwise the analysis is the same. And we don't really know enough here on these facts to know whether it's really a well-founded fear and whether or not it's more likely than not. But you still have to prove that you're going to be persecuted on account of the five protected grounds. The real differences between asylum and withholding is that, you know, higher burden of proof, and also that asylum is discretionary, whereas withholding is mandatory. Plus, there are some bars too that apply in asylum. We didn't get to the bars, but we spoke about one at length. If you don't apply within a year, there's generally a one-year bar, meaning you can't apply for asylum if you don't apply within your first year of coming here, and there's exceptions. But there is no bar for withholding of removal. So if you came 3 years ago and you apply for withholding, that one-year bar won't apply. You should also know, what is the significance of these different standards of review are that if you're denied asylum because you haven't demonstrated persecution or you haven't demonstrated a well-founded fear of persecution, you can't establish withholding of removal because it's really the same question, whether you've been persecuted, except instead of whether it's well-founded, whether or not it's more likely than not. So if you don't meet the well-founded standard, you're definitely not going to meet the more likely than not standard. And the other considerations are pretty much the same. All right, we're done with asylum. So, does anybody have any general questions about asylum before we conclude? All right. I'm going to pass around attendance sheet. I had the one from last class because I ran out. I didn't want to have my assistant print out a whole bunch more. So just sign in the column next to it. If you didn't sign in last class, you can't sign in now. But if you were here and want to send me an email saying I was here but didn't sign in, you can do that. Yeah. Just sign half. You're okay anyway. All right. So, were there questions about asylum? Okay. You guys that just came in, you didn't miss anything. I just gave the first few answers on the test, but you could get them from your classmates. It'll be fine. All right, let's do a... Yes, you have a question?
Yeah. If you're going to argue refugees serve places, that's not the principle you would argue in support of why I should
be. No, it's not... I don't think you have to argue it. You don't have to say, I'm a refugee serve place. It's just a label to just differentiate these types of claims from others.
Okay.
But it's not its own unique brand of asylum. It's just sort of a label you put on it when someone is claiming... refugee status based on activities that occurred in the United States. All right. This is, I think, one of the first presentations I gave you, and since I didn't have time to make a new one, we're going to do this one again as part of our review. And I think it's kind of useful. I like the closure sort of that this brings because it shows like how far we've come. And I remember the look on your faces during the first class and you're like, what the hell's going on here? And I think you'll find some satisfaction in knowing that now you know a little bit what's going on. So we spoke about citizenship, which I thought was a good place to start the discussion, although some classes put citizenship at the end. The reason I like to start with citizenship is because it's important to understand what makes us citizens and what gives us the right to keep others and kick others out of our country, and whether or not there are, in fact, good reasons for that. Now, our immigration laws don't apply to citizens. So if you're a citizen, you don't have to worry about getting deported. Now, the other major area is legal admissions, and this is admitting non-citizens into the United States. There's two classes of non-citizens, which now you're very familiar with. There's the immigrants, who are the class who are trying to come here to live permanently. And these are largely comprised of our legal permanent residents and our refugees, okay, and even our unlawful entrants, because they want to stay permanently. And everybody who's not... an immigrant is a non-immigrant, or those who are just coming to visit temporarily. So they're coming temporarily to work or to visit, and those are all of the, you know, the H and the O and the P and the B visas that we looked at. Now, whether you're coming as an immigrant or a non-immigrant, there's two general requirements. First, you need some qualifying characteristic. And if you're coming as an immigrant, you have to have a qualifying family member, or you have to have a qualifying employment relationship. Or even if you're coming temporarily, you need to fit into one of the enumerated grounds listed in the statutes. That's the first step. The second step is you also have to avoid the negative criteria, which are in 212. Those are our inadmissibility provisions. You can't have been removed in the past. You can't have committed crimes of moral turpitude. You can't be a public charge. And I won't go through all of them, but those are the negative requirements, things that you don't want to have. Because if you have those characteristics, we're not going to let you in. Now, there are waivers and exceptions within these 212 requirements. So there's a very fine line between what a waiver and exception is. Now, I'm not sure the labels are necessarily all that useful, but an exception will be listed in the statute saying you're excludable unless you satisfy or you fall into one of these categories. Okay, we looked at an exception for people that are excluded for foreign policy grounds, for example. And then you have waivers. A 212H is a good example of a waiver, so you could take a look at that. Waivers say, well, you are inadmissible, but, you know, enough time has passed or you have qualifying family members, and because we're trying to look like we're nice people, we're going to let you stay in the country or come into the country even though you were, otherwise satisfy the requirements of Section 212.
All right. The other side of the enforcement, the other side is the enforcement and removal. This is the deportation side. And this serves a number of functions. First, it serves as the safety net to people who slip through the cracks in the admission stage. All right? So if somebody, you know, submitted a document and checked the wrong box, whether fraudulently or intentionally, we're going to fix that with by deporting them. But it also applies to people who came legally, but their time to stay has expired, or they've committed a criminal act, or some other condition that makes them removable under Section 237. Now, the line that separates whether someone is going to be under the provisions of 212 or 237 is whether or not they've made an admission into the United States, and that's a defined term. Okay, someone who's been inspected at the border. Okay, someone who's been inspected at the border and is going to be removed is going to be in deportation proceedings, and somebody who has not been inspected at the border, who's either at the border or who snuck in, are going to be under the provisions of 212. All right? And then, of course, we want to think about our removal process in two stages for people who are in removal proceedings. One, is the person removable? And when I say the word removable, that's not the bottom line. Removable is the first question, meaning are they subject to one of the provisions in 212 or 237? And are any waivers available to them? If there's a waiver available, then they're not going to be removable. Or if there's an exception, okay? But assuming that they fit into one of these conditions in 212 or 237, and there's no exception available, and there's no waiver available, then you proceed to the second step in the analysis, determining whether or not they're entitled to relief from removal. All right, and so we didn't look at all of them, and you don't have to talk about in your exam anything we didn't cover in class, but the ones we talked about, cancellation of removal, voluntary departure, adjustment of status, asylum, did I miss any big ones? Those are the big ones. Withholding of removal. I don't want to be limited to what I just said now. Whatever we covered in class, in more than one sentence, will be a good game for the test. Although we didn't cover all of the different things. Any questions about that, generally? We also spent some time talking about division of powers, which is really, really an important foundation for you to understand all this stuff. You know, immigration law, like most areas of administrative law, lies at the intersection of all three branches of our government. We have Congress who passes the statute. We have the executive branch who interprets the statute either through administrative adjudications or through the regulations. Okay, those are the 8 CFR series. And then we have the judicial branch, which checks to various degrees what the legislative branch and the executive branch are doing. Now, we know that the judicial branch traditionally has afforded an extraordinary amount of deference to the political branches under the so-called plenary doctrine. And I'm not going to go into detail now, but we talked about how the court reviews constitutional problems and also how the court reviews discretionary and factual issues. But in all of those areas, there's a very high degree of deference. Why? Well, because the judicial branch is, again, the politically insulated branch, and these branches are more politically accountable to the people, and so to the extent there are ambiguities or gaps in the law, we want the more politically accountable branches to fill those gaps. Questions about that, gentlemen? And we talked about all the policy reasons behind the immigration law. economic, political, social, national security, moral, others. Now, these interests sometimes align and sometimes they don't. And, you know, in any given case, you have to look to see which of these policy interests is prevailing. And it's Congress that decides in the first instance how to balance these competing interests. And when Congress has left a gap, then it descends upon the administrative agencies to weigh these factors. Michael, you had a question?
How much importance is policy going to have with the gap? Does it mean that you recommend us using it at the end of our analysis of the problems and questions that you pose?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not sure how much it's really going to make a difference, because, like, unless I ask you what you think about a certain policy. And so I would not go. There are going to be limits. I'm going to put page limits on things. And I would not spend, you know, too much time talking about policy unless you think it's relevant to the answer. In which case, you may choose to spend some time talking about it. But if you think you're going to be sacrificing room that you might be using on something else, then you have to make a judgment call whether you think it's important enough to the question being asked. And skills and challenges. I hope that all of you are slightly more advanced in your legal careers after this class. We did a lot of problem solving together, which I hope you found useful and fun. We are reading and applying statutes and regulations, which can be a bear. It's a very difficult process. And I think as we got closer to the end of the class, many more of you were becoming comfortable doing that. That's a very important skill as a lawyer. And not an easy one in the context of immigration, with all the cross-references back and forth. And these statutes are not necessarily artfully worded. But these are the skills of a good lawyer. Navigating through this dense regulatory scheme and mastering a technical vocabulary. I mean, if you think about how many words you now know that you didn't know a few months ago, maybe you care to forget in a few weeks, that's fine. I mean, concepts like removability and excludability and admissibility and LPRs. What is a non-citizen? You know, what's an alien? All these things. And if you and I think you all have a master of these terms now. And you should pat yourselves on each other's backs after class. And, you know, how to think about these things objectively. You know, some people will just come out of the gates and say, you know, I'm an enforcement guy, let's build the fence higher and further. You know, and others will say, well, let's let everybody in. But I think, you know, I've hoped to be able to impart on you how important it is that these are not easy questions. There are no easy questions. That's what all the fighting is about right now. And so to look at these questions objectively with the consideration of the counterbalancing policy interests at stake in any given case. Now, you may still have an opinion, and that's fine, and that's great. Everybody should have an opinion. But at least you know what you're arguing against. You know, you have a reason for it. It's based on your understanding of what the other side's position is. And public speaking. Thank you so much to all of you who participated in class. I really appreciate it. I think it's a good exercise for you. I think you added to the class. And, you know, if I can't even tell you how much I appreciate it. And in instances where I cut you off, it was only because, you know, we have to cover so much material. But it was never because of any lack of appreciation I had for your contributions. All right, that's the class. Why don't we just take a 10-minute break now, and then I'll go over these questions. And then when we're done with the questions, that's going to be the end of class.
I am a puppet.
In a couple of circumstances, whether or not they're subject to, you know, the deportation or the admissibility provisions, it could depend on that. If you weren't admitted, then you're treated as if you're at the border, essentially.
All right.
So, and it also has to do with. It also has to do with timing. So, like, some of the deportation says, you know, if you committed a crime within 3 years of being admitted, for example, or 5 years of being admitted, then you have to see what person is actually on. All
right.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Here's the situation. I lied. This is the situation. I'm going to go through these review questions.
And then I'm giving you a presentation, which we'll not go over too.
I'm presenting a paper that I published last year on an immigration issue. And so I'm going to practice, and I'm going to have you guys be my audience. And I have you till 2 o'clock, so I don't feel bad about it, even though I told you I might let you go early. Now, here's the deal. As part of this presentation, I'm going to get questions. I'm going to present for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then I'm going to get questions and answers, and I encourage you to challenge me. And I encourage you, and you don't have to challenge me. You may agree or disagree, but ask me tough questions, okay? We could do the whole thing in about 30 minutes. But before we do that, I do have some questions I want to answer real quick that I got from some of you. And the issue involves, well, one of the questions I got, which made me think of it. I told you about this issue between Chevron and the rule of lenity. And so that's what the issue relates to. And I think that while it's not nothing I say during my presentation is going to be on the exam per se, it will give you a general sense of some of the interesting issues involved in statutory interpretation, which we did spend some time in class talking about already. Here's some questions, and some of them are very specific, so I want to get through them quickly, so I don't want to spend too much time. Did the court in Ting, this is a plenary power case, did the court in Ting say that the white person clause was not unconstitutional because Congress has the power to exclude? This is what we're going to do, actually. Everybody stop typing. I'm going to make this podcast available, okay? So this way you don't have to, you can just type if you have something that's of interest to you, okay? Was the court saying that it was not unconstitutional because Congress has the power to exclude? Now, Congress clearly said it had the power to exclude, but I don't think that's the end of the question. The question is what constitutional limits, if any, apply to Congress's power to exclude. And in Ting, I think the court said there were none, although the reasoning from the court is a bit obscure. Next question. Can a non-citizen in deportation proceedings appeal their decision to the courts according to Yamatora? I'm not sure what the reference to Yamatora is per se, but let me answer more generally. That yes, non-citizens can appeal to the courts under certain circumstances that Congress provides. Non-citizens who commit aggravated felonies, for example, are not permitted to appeal to the court unless what they're challenging is a constitutional or legal issue. Otherwise, they can. Does a non-citizen in deportation proceedings get administrative review of their case? The answer is yes. If you mean by administrative review, does it go before an immigration judge and a Board of Immigration Appeals? The answer is yes. Does due process extend to non-citizens in deportation proceedings and those non-citizens not in deportation proceedings? Let me take those in parts. Does due process extend to non-citizens in deportation proceedings? Yes, although to a limited degree. And we spent a number of classes talking about to what extent the due process applies. Does it apply to non-citizens not in deportation proceedings? I take that to mean, well, what if it's not an immigration proceeding? And it's just you're a non-citizen and you've been convicted of a crime or whatever. The answer is yes. The restrictions on the constitutional protections generally only apply in the context of a removal proceeding. If you're a non-citizen and just, otherwise living your life and someone takes your property, you're entitled to the same due process as your next-door neighbor is. These are. I'm going to skip the next few because they're very particular. Okay, and then the person who's written these, I'll respond to separately, or you can come talk to me. And they're all about the plenary doctrine and the specifics of some of the cases. What is the statutory provision for accompanying to join? Remember, accompanying to join, that means that under certain circumstances, the spouses or the children can come over with an immigrant. Take a look at section 203D. Under the Immigration Fraud and Marriage Act, if you have been married for 2 years and one day, do you still have to do the marriage fraud interview? The answer is no. If you've been, assuming that you've been married for 2 years and one day prior to seeking admission into the United States, then those provisions don't apply to you. It only applies to people who married within 2 years who try to seek admission.
what's the labor condition application, and is it the same thing as a labor certification application? No, they're slightly different. Labor condition requires the employer to attest that they're paying prevailing wages, that they are that the working conditions are of others will not be adversely affected, and that the employer has notified existing workers to see if they have any objections. Whereas the labor certification application is more in depth, and you have to advertise and for a certain period of time and make sure that there's no one able or that there's no one out there and able to take the job. How many one-year extensions can a person coming under an O visa get? As far as I know, there's no limit. You can keep getting a one-year extension. How many five-year extensions can a person coming in under a P-1 visa get? Well, the P-1 individual athletes get a one five-year extension, and everybody else gets one-year extensions in one-year increments. So if you're a P-1 individual athlete, 5 years, everyone else 1 year. Okay, what waiver is used to promote family unity? Well, that's kind of a broad question. There's a lot of them that promote family unity. Cancellation, all the waivers that require harm, extreme hardship in some way are promoting family unity. 212H is one, cancellation is another example, and there's more. But anytime, there's too many to list now. Do you look? This is, a categorical approach question. Do you look at the elements of the crime that they are convicted of, and then make a determination as to whether it's a crime of moral turpitude? The answer is generally yes. Under the categorical approach, you look to the nature of the crime itself. You look to the elements. Some courts have applied the modified categorical approach, which if the statute is divisible into certain different subsections, some of which would render the non-citizen deportable and others not, then you can look to the charging documents, the record of conviction, the plea colloquy, and other records or other evidence in the record. Now, recently, I should tell you, and I mentioned this in class, that the BIA seems to be backing off from this approach and is more inclined to look at actual circumstances of the case. And they recently did so when it was involved a crime of fraud resulting in $10,000 or more of damages. And the BIA held that, well, you have to look beyond the record of conviction for these sort of tack-on clauses. I think only a couple weeks ago, the BIA extended this principle to the crime of moral turpitude context and said, listen, crime of moral turpitude is never an element of any offense. There's no such thing as a state crime of moral turpitude. So first you do the categorical approach, then you do the modified approach, and then if you still don't know the answer, then under certain circumstances you can actually look to see what the events underlying the crime were. And if you're interested in learning, sort of understanding this a little bit more, the Attorney General just issued this decision. Do a search in the FIM-BIA database, which is the BIA database, and do a search for, for a document including crime of moral turpitude, categorical approach, and modified categorical approach, and you'll see a decision by the Attorney General himself, not the BIA. Basically giving a summary of the split among the courts and how they treat these issues, and now the BIA, or the agency, has now come up with a unified solution to this problem. The question, of course, will be whether or not this gets deference in any of the other courts. But that's a good place to look if you're still having questions about this. Is there a waiver for people who fall under Section 212A to A1 2I? There's an inconsistency in the slides regarding this. I'm not sure, whoever wrote me this, to point out the inconsistency, there might very well be. And if there is, I want to make it clear to everybody else. Now, what we're talking about here is A. Right, so we're talking about our convictions of a violation or conspiracy relating to a controlled substance offense, And is there a waiver for people under here? Here's probably what the inconsistency is. There's no exception, you know, like you have for crimes of moral turpitude. There's no exception, and there's generally not a 212H waiver, except there is if it's for simple possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana. So that may have led to, if there was an inconsistency on the slide or not. So generally, you can't get a waiver for these drug crimes, but 212H will apply in the case of a simple possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana. So it's sort of an exception to the exception. If you're trying to figure out, if this is a good question, if you're trying to figure out if a person is deportable based on their inadmissibility, and you realize that they are inadmissible, which would make them deportable, do you look for a waiver for the inadmissibility or the deportability provision? If somebody is deportable because they were inadmissible at the time of entry, then what you do is you look to see whether there's a waiver of the inadmissibility provision. Because if there's a waiver of the inadmissibility provision, then the person's no longer deportable under that deportation statute. They may be deportable under a different statute, in which case you might need a deportation waiver as well. But if the only thing you're deportable is because you were inadmissible at the time of entry, then you could waive the inadmissibility prong, and then you're clear of that deportation charge at least. Okay. I'm going to skip some of these, the ones that are too specific, and then I'll just focus on the more general ones. It says, why is a non-citizen not able to appeal to the courts when they are not granted relief, or is it that they cannot appeal? I think the confusion here is this. First, non-citizens can appeal to the courts for relief, provided that Congress has given them the right to appeal. And as I mentioned, the general rule is you can appeal, but you cannot appeal under certain circumstances. For example, I've already mentioned if you're an aggravated felon, in which case the only thing you could appeal is a constitutional or legal question. We didn't spend a lot of time on these judicial review provisions, and they're not going to be on the test, but you should be aware in general that these appeals are available to the courts, but only under certain circumstances. I think the confusion is because I mentioned that the government cannot appeal. The government cannot appeal to the circuit courts if a non-citizen is granted relief. So the government can appeal to the Attorney General, and if they lose at the agency level, well, then the person gets their benefits and the government goes home, and fine, they go on to the next case. All right. New set of questions from a different student. Is there currently a condition subsequent requirement for attaining citizenship by descent? The answer is no. Is there currently a condition subsequent requirement for attaining citizen by descent? The answer is under the current scheme, no. But whether the current scheme applies or not depends on, obviously, we talked about, depends on when the applicant was born. So you have to look at that.
To clarify that,
yeah.
So you don't have to, so if you're obtaining citizenship by descent, you don't have to, like, reside in.
If you qualify under the newest provision, because all of these requirements are sort of retroactive, and remember that chart we looked at in the textbook, you have to look to see which citizenship provision applies depending on when you were born, or if you're looking at the parents when the parents were born. You know, for those who fall under the newest provision, there aren't no longer any conditions subsequent. That's eventually that will be the rule unless they change it again, because everybody else is sort of going to die. You know, and age out, and then what's left is, you know, we'll have the current system.
They mean their children obtain citizenship by descent if they go to the United States.
May who?
May. So, you know, someone obtains citizenship by descent, right, and they don't have a condition subsequent, so they don't come to the United States.
Right.
May their children obtain citizenship by descent?
Presumably, under your facts, assuming that the children were obviously born after the parents, but if you're saying that there's no condition subsequent under the newest provision, and the newest provision applies to the parents, then obviously it's going to apply to the children.
So theoretically, you have people who are American citizens and live in Italy, who always live in Italy, and will always live in Italy.
We could have...
That's right. If both the parents are citizens of the United States, right? there's no condition subsequent on the child. There was a question about how much public welfare LPRs can get. The answer is it's not on the test. So certain types of LPRs can get certain types of welfare benefits. I don't want to get into the specifics. Those seeking reentry, are they entitled to some due process as if they were analogous to immigrants who are already here and being deported? That's a good question. These are like some of the difficult questions. The answer is generally that those seeking reentry are treated at the border, even if they were previously LPRs. Think about Nizai, right? But then you have some sort of limiting principles to that. We looked at Chu as a contrasting example, where the person was previously given permission to leave the country, and then land in Plasencia, where the person only left for a couple days. But in general, you know, I'm assuming none of those exceptions apply. If you leave the country, even if you're an LPR, and you come back, and you commit a crime when you're gone, and now all of a sudden you're in exclusion proceedings, the fact that you used to be an LPR doesn't necessarily give you any greater due process protection. That was really what the issue in his eye was. How does the current law deal with a country using up its quotas for any given year? That's a good question. Well, there's a backlog. So if a country uses all of its spots, then the line gets bigger next year, and then the line gets bigger next year. That's why some countries, you have to wait 14 years to come into the country, because the quotas are being used, and there's the demand far out exceeds the supply. There must have been a confusion, either something I said or whatever, but someone wanted to know, can you apply defensively for asylum and withholding of removal? Meaning, so you don't affirmatively apply when you get here, okay, but you're placed in removal proceedings, can you defensively apply? Or maybe you affirmatively apply and they thought you were lying, and then you're put in deportation proceedings, can you defensively apply? And the answer is yes. You could apply for asylum and you could apply for withholding. In fact, the immigration judge, by regulation, is required to construe an asylum application for a withholding one. And they're physically on the same piece of paper. So when you submit your application for asylum, it says application for asylum, withholding of removal, and actually Convention Against Torture Relief, which we didn't cover. All right. So that's the end of the questions I got. And there was a few I didn't address, which I will follow up on with the students, but they were a little too specific. So let me talk to you a little bit about what I think to be is a rather perplexing issue in administrative law. And we spent some time in class talking about it. And like I said at the end, I hope that you'll share your comments with me. And if you have any suggestions, I'm either in my presentation or whatever, I'm happy to hear those as well. The focus is on ambiguous immigration statutes. I'm not concerned with the interpretation of any one statute in particular, but rather more theoretically, what the judiciary's role is relative to the executive branch in sorting out the statutory ambiguities that are left behind by Congress. Now, the issue is complicated, as you know, because there are two doctrines, both created by the Supreme Court, both relating to the interpretation of ambiguous immigration statutes, but which in practice point in opposite directions. On the one hand, you have the rule of lenity, which is a canon of construction, which, in order to give non-citizens a modicum of protection against the harsh consequences of deportation, requires courts to construe ambiguous immigration statutes leniently in favor of non-citizens. Now, the second doctrine is not so much a canon of construction as it is a framework for judicial review of administrative interpretations of regulatory statutes, and that's the Chevron doctrine. I'll talk more later about what Chevron is and why we have Chevron. But at bottom, Chevron requires reviewing courts to defer to any reasonable interpretation of the agency of ambiguous statutes. So here's the question. What is a reviewing court to do when faced with the immigration agency's interpretation of the statute that is detrimental to the non-citizen and therefore is in some tension with the rule of lenity, but is otherwise reasonable in light of competing governmental interests and is therefore consistent with Chevron. Now, my thesis, in short, is that under these circumstances that the reviewing court must defer to the agency's reasonable interpretation, and that the rule of lenity should yield to Chevron and apply only if the court first determines that the statute's ambiguous and that the agency's interpretation is unreasonable. Now, the issue has attracted the attention of some other commentators and scholars, but I largely found their analyses to be unsettling for reasons I'll explain later. The Supreme Court has not addressed the issue, and quite understandably, given the room for disagreement, the lower circuit courts are all over the map. Now, as the discussion unravels, I hope you'll come to appreciate what I do about this issue. It's not simply one of statutory interpretation. It's not simply one of immigration, although that's where the focus is. Rather, resolving the Lenity-Chevron conflict requires a hard look at democratic theory, one which tries to grapple with the legitimacy and the normative desirability of courts injecting their own public values or their own ideologies into the process of statutory interpretation. Now, for purposes of this discussion, I've organized my subject into three general parts. First, some general background on immigration, which should come very naturally to you all. Second, some detail and theory behind the lenity and Chevron doctrines. And finally, a concluding discussion, which, as the title of my article suggests, seeks to put the immigration rule of lenity in its proper place, as a tool of last resort after Chevron. Now, immigration is, as you all know, since you're here, is an emerging and important area of the law. It's hotly contested in the halls of Congress and in town halls and around kitchen tables and dining room tables across the country. As you may not know, however, is how important immigration law has been in the courts. The Second Circuit's current docket is comprised of 60% of everything else and 40% of immigration. Now, not all of those cases involve issues of statutory interpretation, but many of them do. So what is all the fuss about anyway? Well, at bottom is the appreciation that our immigration system reflects an intricate web of often inextricable interests. Humanitarian concerns, foreign relations, national security, the economy, just to name a few. Now, while these interests sometimes align, sometimes they don't. And so the question becomes, how and by whom are these policy interests to be balanced in any given case? Well, under our constitutional structure, it is Congress that decides in the first instance how to balance these competing interests. Congress, however, is often silent or ambiguous in its statutory enactments. Sometimes that ambiguity is unintended. Even when Congress wants to be perfectly clear, the ambiguity that inheres in language makes it impossible for it to always be so. Moreover, Congress cannot always foresee the circumstances in which its statutory language will apply to real-world facts. Now, Congress sometimes is also intentionally ambiguous or intentionally silent. Well, why is that? Well, sometimes Congress simply doesn't have the time to hammer out all the details. And sometimes Congress would prefer to pass symbolic legislation, but members of Congress don't want to expend the political capital necessary for filling in all of the policy gaps. Well, the residue that results from these ambiguities and gaps, regardless of whether it's ambiguous, intentional or not, devolves to somebody, and the question is who between the courts and the agency are going to pick up and exercise the power of filling in these statutory gaps. Now, Congress has delegated rulemaking authority to the Attorney General and to the Secretary of Homeland Security, and pursuant to that authority, the Attorney General and Secretary pass rules pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act, but also decide policy questions on a case-by-case basis in the context of administrative adjudications.
Now, rounding out the judiciary, rounding out the division of powers, excuse me, is the judiciary, of course, which checks to various degrees what Congress and the agencies are doing. Now, traditionally, under the so-called plenary doctrine, the court has been extraordinarily deferential to the political branches in the creation of our immigration laws. Now, the source of that deference is a bit amorphous, right? We spent lots of classes talking about that. But at bottom, it reflects an appreciation that as between the courts on the one side and the political branches on the other, that the political branches are better suited in terms of democratic pedigree and in terms of practicalities for sorting out the details of our immigration system. Now, this traditional posture traces back to the late 1800s, almost a full year before Chevron was even decided. Let's talk about Chevron. It famously created a two-step framework for the review of administrative interpretations of statute, decided in 1984 in an environmental case, but it extends to all regulatory agencies. Under step one of Chevron, the reviewing court looks to see whether or not Congress has clearly spoken to the issue. If Congress has clearly spoken, that ends the matter. But if the statute is silent or ambiguous, the court proceeds to Chevron's second step, and under that step, the court looks to see whether or not the agency's interpretation is reasonable. Now, what is reasonable? Well, you can think of it either as a spectrum on which there are no right answers, or a zone of indeterminacy in which there are no right answers. But the concept of reasonableness was intended to ensure that courts would not substitute their own judgment for the agency's reasonable judgment. Now, the court itself provided three general reasons for this deference. First, on democratic grounds, it recognized that filling in statutory gaps and ambiguities requires policy choices, and that to the extent that it involves policy choices, that the more politically accountable agency should be making those determinations. While the court recognized that the agency heads are not directly accountable to the people, agency heads are directly accountable to the chief executive, who in turn is directly accountable to we the people. The second justification for Chevron is that it rests on an assumption or a fiction that when Congress leaves gaps or ambiguities in the statute, that it intends the agency to reasonably fill those gaps, and that for the court to substitute its own judgment for the agency would be stepping on Congress's toes and replacing itself for Congress's chosen delegate. Now, finally, Chevron, one of the reasons in Chevron was more normative, and that is because agencies, more so than the courts, have expertise in these matters, and that as between the courts and the agencies, it's better to have the more technically able agencies to sort out these details than the courts. Now, notwithstanding these proffered reasons for Chevron deference, Chevron left many unanswered questions. One of them, which is directly relevant to the Lenity-Chevron conflict, is how canons of construction are to be used within Chevron's two-step framework, either at step one, in determining whether or not Congress has directly spoken to the issue, or at step two, in determining whether or not the agency's interpretation is reasonable. In a footnote, the court says in Chevron that reviewing courts can consider, quote-unquote, traditional tools of statutory interpretation. At step one in determining whether or not Congress has spoken to the issue. The problem is that tools of construction come in many flavors, and whether or not a particular canon is a traditional one is a matter of much debate. The other problem is that the court did not explain how canons are to be used, if at all, at Chevron's second step. Let's turn to the rule of lenity, which is as one such canon. Now, the rule of lenity is a substantive canon of construction, which, unlike other textualist canons, which look to the text of a statute or the placement of commas, substantive canons are value-laden judgments or presumptions about what Congress intends during when it legislates and when it considers legislation.
Now, the genesis of the rule of lenity traces to the Supreme Court's decision in Tan v. Phelan 60 years ago. And in that case, in construing a deportation favorably, a deportation statute favorably for a non-citizen, the court explained that because deportation was a drastic measure, that it would not assume that Congress meant to entrench on the non-citizen's freedom any more so than what was required by the narrowest of possible meanings in the statute. Now, while the court's stated reason was to protect against the harsh consequences of deportation, commentators since the time Phelan was decided have offered some additional reasons as animating the rule. One is to protect non-citizens who have no voting rights against particularly adverse legislation. Another reason has been offered to protect non-citizens from judicial biases. And a third, simply to offset the otherwise highly deferential posture under the so-called plenary doctrine. Now, let's get to the fun part with that background behind us, trying to put the immigration rule of lenity in its proper place. But let me just begin with a concrete example that you could hold on to as we sort of work through this together. Congress passes a statute. This is just a hypothetical. Congress passes a statute which renders deportable someone who's been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude. Right? So we all know what that is now. But Congress doesn't define what a crime of moral turpitude is. Someone comes along and commits a DUI in Arizona State, let's say, and is placed in removal proceedings by the immigration agency on the ground that this person who committed the DUI has in fact committed a crime of moral turpitude. And so the issue in the case is whether or not driving under the influence is what Congress considered or would consider to be a crime of moral turpitude. The alien, of course, will argue that he should be given the benefit of the doubt under the rule of lenity. And the government will argue that the agency's interpretation should be given the doubt under the Chevron principle. So what is the reviewing court to do? Now, some courts and commentators have suggested putting the immigration rule of lenity at Chevron step one. The theory for this approach is possible by Chevron's invitation that courts consider traditional tools of statutory construction at step one, and that the rule of lenity is one such canon. I have a number of problems with this approach, however. The first is that to the extent we're trying to glean Congress's clear intent, I'm not so sure the rule of lenity sheds any intent on congressional intent. The rule of lenity is a transmutable concept that affords the non-citizen the most beneficial interpretation under the statute, whatever that may be. In this way, the rule of lenity is unlike other canons, which explain to Congress what the default rule will be if Congress doesn't clearly speak. For example, if Congress does not clearly indicate a statute to operate retroactively, it will operate prospectively. And so you have a clear default rule. In the context of this rule of lenity, Congress doesn't know what the particular result will be if the statute is deemed ambiguous, and therefore it does not really glean or shed any light on Congress's intent, which is the thrust of the step one inquiry. Moreover, applying the rule of lenity at step one would effectively trump any notion of Chevron deference. Because any time you had an ambiguity, the rule of lenity would jump in to cure the ambiguity, and you would never have occasion to get to Chevron's second step. And I just don't think that's possibly what Congress could have intended when it delegated rulemaking authority to the agencies. So that's step one. Now, commentators have also suggested two approaches of using the rule of lenity at step two. Under the first approach, the agency would be required to apply the rule of lenity, and if the agency failed to apply the rule of lenity, it would be deemed an unreasonable interpretation. My problem with that is that while the agency is certainly free to consider the rule of lenity, and indeed has done so on many occasions, to require the agency to consider the rule of lenity might come at the cost of unduly marginalizing competing governmental interests, and the agency should be able to decide in any given case whether or not the rule of lenity should be applied or not. The second approach would be to require that the agency would not be required to apply the rule of lenity at step two, but the reviewing courts would apply it in determining whether or not the agency's interpretation is reasonable. That is, the courts would look at the rule of lenity as a factor in determining whether or not the agency's interpretation of the statute was reasonable.
Now, while this approach, I think, is preferable to some of the others we've considered, I think that even that approach goes too far. First, you have to understand that it would require a reconfiguring of the rule of lenity from a tiebreaker, which has generally been used to break a tie in cases where, after you've applied other tools of construction, it's still not clear which way the arrow is pointing. To use the rule of lenity as a factor in every given case, I don't think the Supreme Court had that in mind in crafting the doctrine to begin with. That aside, however, I have two principal concerns with using lenity as a factor at step two. The first is that it would place on the scale a thumb of indeterminate weight. You know, the rule of lenity could be applied slightly or heavily or mediumly, and it's, that seems to me to provide exactly the type of discretion in circuit courts that Chevron was intended to eliminate. My second problem is that applying the rule of lenity would essentially limit the spectrum of reasonableness. For example, if without the rule of lenity, any of A, B, C, or D interpretations would be reasonable, and applying the rule of lenity, only interpretations A and B would be reasonable, well, then you're limiting the amount of choices available to the implementing agency. And whatever merit there might be to doing that in other administrative contexts, I don't think that that should be the case in immigration, largely for the reasons I began this discussion with. The immigration law requires a delicate balancing of interests, and the political branches should be able to balance these without any handicaps or any hindrances that would give preferences to the rights of non-citizens simply because the statute at issue is ambiguous. So if the rule of lenity doesn't apply at step one or step two, well, what's left of the rule of lenity? Well, two things. First, the rule of lenity will apply in any given case where there's no conflict with Chevron. Chevron does not always apply. For example, if there's a constitutional issue involved, Chevron won't apply. Or if there's an indication that Congress did not intend to actually delegate responsibility to make rules to the agency, Chevron will not apply. But in cases where Chevron applies, the rule of lenity should have a marginal role. It should apply only if the court determines after step one that the statute's ambiguous, and only if the court determines under step two that the agency's interpretation is unreasonable. This approach, I submit, is the best approach because it most comports with the purposes and policies of the lenity and Chevron doctrines by giving the enforcing agency a first bite at interpreting the statute, and if that interpretation is unreasonable, allowing at that point the courts to step in and invoke the rule of lenity in favor of non-citizens. That brings me to the end of my presentation, whatever I could squeeze in 15 or 20 minutes. But I'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, and any questions that you all have. Let's hear. Yes, Michael. Right. Well, this building of the wall is an example, right? Right. So Congress says build a wall. Okay. But it left out a lot of the specifics. It included some, but left a lot of the specifics to the agency to fill in. Yeah.
If the rule of lenity is like an old doctrine, I'm not sure, like, you know, when it developed, but it's
19 about 60 years ago.
So I'm assuming that it's about as old or older than Chevron.
It's older than Chevron.
It's older than
Chevron. Right.
So if the rule of lenity has been around for a long time, then maybe when Congress is making statutes that are, when they're silent or ambiguous, they already have that in consideration when they're making
right.
the rules for the courts to apply. So, I mean, that doesn't really address the issue of when to apply, but I think that you could argue that the courts know that the courts, I mean, that Congress knows that the courts will apply.
Right. So that's it's a very good point. The question or the point was, because of the age of the rule of lenity, that when Congress legislates, it has it in mind as a background convention, essentially. And that is precisely what the argument is for using it under Chevron's first step, is that if Congress knows about the rule of lenity and legislates with it in the back of its mind, then it does shed light on congressional
over 10. My problem with that is that it doesn't shed light on any particular congressional intent. I mean, at most it sheds light on a presumption, which I'm not sure is supported anywhere, that Congress intends for ambiguous statutes to be interpreted leniently. But it doesn't tell the agency or any individual what the particular outcome will be. And that's why I was trying to contrast it to other substantive canons. Like, there's a canon against extraterritoriality of our statutes. You know, if Congress doesn't say that a statute is going to operate beyond our borders, the presumption is that it's not going to. And that's such an old presumption that Congress probably does know about it. But in addition to knowing about it, at least Congress knows what the particular result's going to be if it's ambiguous, whereas in the rule of lenity context, it wouldn't. And that's one of my concerns with applying it in step one. Brian?
Just to address that, if Chevron came after that, then he said that Congress's intent actually goes to Chevron. We need to argue the difference in what the agencies would say that's what they're doing, that the rule of lenity is something that agency can, but if they don't, then that's what they're
doing. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. Now, it's a very interesting point. You know, because Congress hasn't codified lenity and it hasn't codified Chevron. They both really rest on presumptions about congressional intent. Chevron itself rests on a presumed intent that Congress intends for the agency to fill the gap. But Congress never said so. You know, chances are, and I would love to, you know, do empirical study on this, although I wouldn't know how to go about doing it. If you ask Congress members whether they knew the principle of Chevron, I think a lot of them probably would, although maybe not necessarily. If you ask them if they knew about the principle of lenity, I can assure you that many fewer of them would have any idea that this doctrine existed, and might turn around and propose a legislation called the rule of severity. But, you know, that remains to be seen. It's a good question, though, Patrick.
So, marginalizing the rule of lenity, like, essentially gives more power to the agency.
Right.
And so that's the given, right? The question is...
I'm not sure it gives more power. I think it gives them the full spectrum that Chevron affords them.
Right.
So it doesn't give them more, it doesn't give them any more than Chevron affords, but it gives them what Chevron affords.
It gives them more than not marginalizing the rule of lenity.
Right, it gives them more than if the rule of lenity applied to step two. Right.
And so that being given, right, is it, you know, Congress's intent to say we're going to allow people to appeal to a circuit court, but not allow that circuit court to apply its rule of lenity? Right, like, and by that I mean, you know, if Congress's intent is to have the you know, Board of Immigration Appeals checked by the courts, mm-hmm. Would it not be Congress's intent to make sure that the courts have the power to really check them?
Right. Well, I think that's really the heart of the issue, is that, you know, when the court is checking, how far can the court impose its own value judgments? For example, the judgments reflected in the rule of lenity versus the value judgments reflected in Chevron. So the fact that the agencies give, the Congress has given judicial review might simply be to allow non-citizens the right to appeal to check to see whether or not the statute's ambiguous and whether the agency's interpretation is reasonable. But I don't think there's anything in particular about the rule of lenity that... or Congress's grant of judicial review that would require the agency to get the benefit of doubt in any close case.
Sure, but isn't it true that you know, in giving that, you know, power to the courts to check, you know, the immigration, the Board of Immigration Appeals, isn't it true that Congress, at least, or can we assume that Congress's purpose is to avoid arbitrary judgments that become part of the Board of Immigration?
Yes.
Right, so they want the court to put in its own value judgment and what? Say, look, this is what we think is good, or this is what we think is bad about what they're doing. Where Congress hasn't spoken directly to the issue.
Right, but you've used an important word, which is arbitrary. And so that's precisely what Chevron's second step allows the courts to do in determining whether it's reasonable, to look to see whether it's arbitrary. If it is arbitrary, then the courts need not defer under Chevron.
So if the Board of Immigration Appeals arbitrarily says we're not going to apply the rule of lenity in any cases, right, you would agree that, or you would say that that is like under step two of Chevron, right, then the Board of Immigration Appeals, in refusing to consider any limiting rule, would be arbitrary. But if they say sometimes we consider it, sometimes we won't, it's not necessarily arbitrary.
Oh, so you're saying that because the agency should have to make a decision to always apply it or never apply it.
I'm saying if the agency decides that they're never going to apply it, right? Like, you get a new director of Homeland Security and they say, we don't like immigrants and we want to eliminate the rule of lenity in our appeals decisions, and by regulation we're going to do that, right? Can the court then say that would be an arbitrary, or would the court say that's an arbitrary under your scheme of marginalizing the rule of lenity? Would the court then say, well, in that case, it's an arbitrary marginalization or elimination of the rule of lenity, and we're going to apply it as the court, as opposed to saying, under Chevron, we're going to defer to what they say, and if they decide not to apply lenity in this case, that's their prerogative.
Yeah, it's a very good question and an interesting question. Generally, what reviewing courts do in Chevron analyses is to look at the conclusion reached, the substantive conclusion reached by the agency, and not the manner in which it reaches it. So, are we going to require the agency to consider legislative history, for example? That's an issue of much debate even among judges, whether or not legislative history should be considered. Are we going to require the agency to consider canons of construction, and if so, which ones? I think that an agency could come along and decide we're not going to apply the rule of lenity anymore. Remember, all that would do is really level the playing field, or at least to some extent. I mean, if an agency came along and said we're going to strictly construe statutes, then that's looking a little bit worse. But not applying the rule of lenity simply puts the non-citizen interest on par with competing interests. And I don't have any problem per se with that. Whether or not and across the board now, if the agency were never going to apply the rule of lenity, whether that's a reasonable approach is a sort of a separate Chevron question. And I don't know. I don't know what the court would do. It's an interesting question. Michael?
Don't you feel it's just time to just come across the board immigration reform that addresses this problematic issue as a component of the across the board 21st
century immigration policy that I think we can draw? So you're suggesting a statute that either codifies the rule of lenity.
Yeah. So that they speak directly on this issue among many other problems.
Right. Yeah. Well, it gets to the question of, should we be allowing Congress to legislate so broadly? Or as a matter of democracy, is it better to force Congress to deliberate on these hard questions? Well, right. And that's the problem. And there's a whole area of administrative law, which if any of you are taking it or have taken it, it talks about to what extent Congress can delegate authority. Congress can't just give a blank check to the agency. So where do you draw the line of giving the agencies enough guidance? Certainly, it'd be great if Congress would address whether or not the rule of lenity was really its intent. And it would be great if they codified or decided we think Chevron's bad law. But in the meantime, they haven't done it. And the problem with getting rid of the rule of lenity or codifying it is you have the same political considerations and people who don't want to expend the political capital to get rid of a rule. It would require someone to stand up and say, I want to get rid of the rule of lenity. Or it may require someone to say, I want the rule of lenity, I want to put it on the books. And then you have everybody standing up saying, well, why are we giving these benefits to non-citizens? Why are we going to presume that? So that's part of the whole problem.
Okay, but don't you feel that the current political climate isn't really conducive to the attitude that you just suggested, a more like right-wing, more extremist attitude and whatnot? Don't you find it more that more people are becoming a little bit
They might be, and if they are enough so, it's precisely, at least one of the policies that Chevron reflects, is that let's leave these choices to the political branches. If the value judgments in our country are such that we want to adopt a rule of lenity as a statute, or a rule of severity as a statute, and there's enough people to vote for it, and it's constitutional, I can't see why it wouldn't be constitutional, then great. The problem is that I'm not even sure members of Congress know that this issue even exists. And if they did know it existed, what they would do about it. Rosa?
I think it would be better for Congress to leave more discretion to the courts, because it's not in their political self-interest to really legislate on this issue as much, just because their constituency are really divided over the issue. So I really think that, since I seriously doubt that they would be able to come into a conclusion about either Chevron or the rule of lenity in the context of immigration, they should really leave it to the courts and let them decide. Because that way they could answer to the Constitution and say, well, you know, it's really out of our hands. They kind of shove it to the courts, and the courts can more practically and less biasedly decide on their own.
Right. So one of the criticisms of Chevron is that maybe it's giving up too much of this power to fill in the blanks, and maybe we should let the courts make these value judgments, because as the non-political branch, they can take sort of a more even-handed approach to these things. There's certainly an argument to be made for that. The question is whether or not you want to give that power to the courts versus the agency. I think the problem with the approach of giving it to the courts per se are at least twofold. It sort of assumes that the court's going to get it right. Right? The agency might get it right, even though the agency might have more of an interest in the outcome. The court not having as big an interest in the outcome, that might be true, but it's not going to guarantee that the court's going to get it any more right than the agency got it right. And if the courts, whether they get it right or not, are not applying a strong version of deference, then what happens is circuit splits. And I don't think having circuit splits is a good result either. One of the goals of the administrative law is the uniformity of the law. And if you have courts, one court here imposing their own value judgments and another court in California imposing their own value judgments, you're going to get a split. Whereas under Chevron, if what the test is whether the agency's interpretation is reasonable, you're much less likely to get a division of opinions between the circuit courts. Yeah.
I mean, I know that splits are usually not, you know, something that you would want. But I think in the issue of immigration, like other issues that are really divisive when it comes to state by state, I think it might actually be a good thing, because then it would let, kind of like evolve, it would let states do what they want to do, while at the same time not making a strict a rule that would apply across the line. I don't think that they're going to be able to figure out a rule that they could apply across the line. So I kind of see it more like a vow. Let each decide.
Okay, and then immigrants that want to benefit from the NYSA circuit will just come to that port instead of New York. Okay, Patrick?
That's fine.
I'm not criticizing that. I just want to get some more questions.
So the rule of money is inherently a value judgment based, right? So if it's not a split in the courts, right, it's a split in the ways that different members of the Board of Immigration Appeals or immigration officers at the lower level interpret, or decide to apply or not apply to the money. Right? So the question is, do you want to split in the courts or do you want to split in the administrative agency? And it's fair to say one way or the other is better, but I think it's important to note that, since the rule of money is inherently subjective, the splits can be something.
Right. Well, I think that the splits of the agency aren't going to occur on the same level. You have immigration judges throughout the country, but none of those are precedential decisions until at least it gets to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and then it becomes an issue that's warranting of Chevron deference. And generally, these splits are going to be resolved rather quickly. The difference between the circuit splits and the courts is that the Supreme Court, while in theory is there to resolve these splits, it can't resolve all of them. There's just too many. And so in the meantime, you have all these circuit splits, which is not, terrible in itself. I mean, circuit splits are good because it creates a dialogue. And so maybe circuit splits are going to get Congress back to the drafting board to deliberate more about these things. The problem is sort of in the interim that we're not sure what the law is anymore. And if there is a circuit split, then it looks more like no one's really right about it, right? If reasonable judges can reach contrary conclusions, shouldn't we just be letting the agency decide, right? Why are we going to let the judges decide? Because if there is room for disagreement, let's let the agency decide, because they're more accountable to the people.
Right, but then splits in the agency, splits in the agency end up being quieter, right? So you get the quiet splits in the agency where there are differences in whether or not the previous immigrant court BIA judge
right.
is going to apply the rule 180 or that BIA judge is going to apply the rule 180. And because the BIA can also, you know, has presidential authority on the immigration officers, but judges can, immigration court of immigration appeals judges can, you know, modify previous rulings and things like that. So it splits in the BIA in the, you know, not going notice by Congress at all. Right? So not only do we have, you know, an unclear rule that's sort of not even handedly applied, Congress isn't going to do anything about it. Instead of
right. Well, if there's a question as to whether Congress even knows about circuit splits, and there's been some studies on that, they don't always know. They generally start opening up their eyes when the Supreme Court has decided something, although there are some circuit splits that get Congress's attention. So what are you proposing, though? I mean, are you proposing an alternative? Or?
No, I'm just observing that
there's no perfect solution here.
Well, there's no perfect solution, but, you know, like, I don't know the answer to the question, but I'm asking the question as to whether or not it's preferable to have circuit splits for BIA's, you know, internal problems.
Right. Michael?
You mentioned that the agency is internal. Well, I'm not entirely convinced that the agencies are actually controlling people already. Like, if you go to a state court, so lots of times they're elected judges, it would seem like they're more controlling than the rest of the agencies.
Uh-huh. Right. I think that, you know, you look at it, and you're right, one of the criticisms is sort of the capture of these agencies by the people that are the agencies are supposed to be regulating. But, I mean, you look at this the most recent election. It may be some time before there's a shakeup, but the people have spoken, and we're going to get a new Attorney General, we're going to get a new Secretary of Homeland Security. And so, I mean, at least at some level, it may take some time, but we are going to get political response.
It seems like the accountability and, you know, the agency gets ignored from Congress, and the accountability of the executive, I think, you know, just in general, it's still more like the agency, like, they don't really know where the agency stands, but the congressional,
right.
The top of Congress being accountable.
Right, right. It's not clear. All right, so I'm going to thank you, by the way. I'm going to call it because I see some of you are getting anxious to get out of here. But anyway, I thought it was, your questions are great, so thank you. And for those of you who sent me questions that I didn't answer, I will follow up with you. And if you have any additional questions, of course, I'm available to respond to them, okay?
Tomorrow is Wednesday.
So tomorrow's Wednesday, but it's canceled. There's no class tomorrow.
Oh, at all?
No, there's no immigration class.